alcoholic. And I always have been an alcoholic and always will be an alcoholic. And today, thanks to Alcoholics Anonymous, the program found in the big book, the fellowship found in the rooms, and a loving higher power, I'm a recovered alcoholic. And that's a miracle. Happy birthday to all the birthday people. So awesome that you guys all get to share a sobriety date with Dr. Bob, you know, I mean, so cool. Today is not Founders Day. That was yesterday, but Dr. Bob celebrated the last day he drank instead of the first day he was sober. So basically you do have the same sobriety date, as Dr. Bob from any angle you want to look at it. I do have a sponsor and I do sponsor others. Obviously I also have a home group, sobriety date of, 3/10/2010, 3/25/2000, March 25th, 2010. I'm trying to do the just numbers only, but I can't do that yet. So other speakers can, I can't. March 25th, 2010. And you know, I guess what qualifies me, today is not necessarily my sobriety date, or even that I have a home group, but we're on the chapter working with others. And that's something that I've done quite a bit of in Alcoholics Anonymous. That's the one thing I think that I haven't taken a break from, you know, in AA. And ever since I had been given this amazing gift of, you know, sobriety, but not just freedom from alcohol from the neck down, but freedom from alcohol up here, ever since that obsession has been removed, I can't help but want to give back. I do service work in the fellowship, general service, obviously, that's not obvious. General service is, you know, our third legacy service, which to me, I don't have to do to stay sober, district area, GSO stuff. I don't have to do that to stay sober. But the service that comes in the recovery side of the triangle is my own step work. I have to do that to stay sober. I have to give away what was so freely given to me. I have to take other women through this process that someone took me through. And that is how, that's the service that I have to do. I do the other service, general service, third legacy service, so that the alcoholic not yet born can stay sober. But I don't have to do that to stay sober. This, what we're going to be talking about today, this is where my sobriety is. This is 90%. This is the foundation. My step 12 combined with someone else's step one, it's the same thing. Or when I was 12 steps, my step one, my foundation was someone else's 12 step. And that's where this whole thing, you know, makes full circle. So I'm going to start at the bottom of page. I'm going to start backtrack by just one sentence. So before working with others, which starts on page 89, I'm going to go to the last part of page 88. So pages 1 through 88 is basically the first 11 steps, right? So step 11 starts on the bottom of page 85 and it goes through page 88. And there's some really clear cut directions in that. And it kind of ties it all up in that last paragraph of the chapter that says, we alcoholics are undisciplined. So we let God discipline us in this simple way we've just outlined. So that chapter was a simple outline of how I, a goal of how I try to strive, never perfectly, but hopefully progressing to live my life one day at a time. Then it says, but that's not all. That's only 11 steps, right? Now it's going to get into the real SH here. It says there's action and more action. Faith without works is dead. So no matter how much you pray and meditate, without the work, don't mean nothing. So what work? What does that mean? What does faith without works is dead mean? Well, the next chapter is entirely devoted to step 12, working with others. That's the work I have to do. That's the work in giving it away that allows me to keep it. So this first part is beautiful. So working with others, practical experience shows that nothing will so much ensure immunity from drinking as intensive work with other alcoholics. Now, I think that this could be really easy to have left out the word intensive. I think that, you know, if we were just talking about, I don't know, secretarying a meeting, making some coffee, then it would have been easy to say, nothing will so much ensure immunity from drinking as work with other alcoholics. But it doesn't. It says intensive work, right? Getting down to the nitty gritty, one alcoholic with another, that language of the heart, that magic of me too, that connection that only an alcoholic with another alcoholic can achieve. It works when other activities fail. This is our 12th suggestion. Carry your message. Oops, nope, it does not say to carry your message. It says carry this message, right? And I don't know how I missed that, because I ran around Alcoholics Anonymous for the first couple of years carrying my message to whoever would hear it. carry this message to other alcoholics. You can help when no one else can. You can ensure their confidence when others fail. Remember, they're very ill. These are some of my favorite 12-step promises. Ready for this? So beautiful. Life will take on new meaning. To watch people recover, to see them help others, to watch loneliness vanish, to see a fellowship grow up about you, to have a host of friends. This is an experience you must not miss. Then they say it again. We know you will not want to miss it. Frequent contact with newcomers and with each other is the bright spot of our lives. Isn't that the truth? For someone who, at the beginning of when I was coming around the fellowship, I'm not going to say when I started, when I came to the program, because the program is in here and I didn't get the program until I was a member of the fellowship for some time. So when I was starting to come around the fellowship, I mean, I would wake up every morning, and I know that this sounds really selfish and self-centered, but I guess that's the case. That's what I was. And when I would wake up, my first thought was not gratitude. My first thought was not, oh, thank God I'm sober and I know where my car is and I'm not kicked out of a bar and I don't owe a bunch of apologies for stuff I don't remember saying. Thank God. You know, that I wasn't thankful. I wasn't grateful. My first thought was, oh my God, I have to go to another AA meeting with those people. Like, that was my first thought in AA. And I would remember to come in 5 minutes late so that you guys didn't have to touch me or talk to me or look at me. And then I would leave 5 minutes early so you didn't have to pray on me, you know? And that was kind of, that was who I was. And I did not. Frequent contact with you was not the bright spot of my life. It just wasn't. It was like the dreaded, the chore, you know. I mean, I would have rather done laundry and dishes than hung out with you guys. And again, you know, these are the promises that come true as a result of doing the work. They don't come true as a result of hanging around for 90 days or whatever, you know, graduating your treatment or whatever. And so today, when I read that, I can honestly say in all sincerity, the bright spot of my life today is frequent contact with newcomers and with you guys. That is the bright spot of my life. Perhaps you are not acquainted with any drinkers who want to recover. call them off the bar stools. No, no, you can easily find some by asking a few doctors, ministers, priests, or hospitals. They will be only too glad to assist you. Don't start out as an evangelist or a reformer. Unfortunately, a lot of prejudice exists. You will be handicapped if you arouse it. Ministers and doctors are competent, and you can learn much from them if you wish. But it happens that because of your own drinking experience, this is a highlight in my book, because of your own drinking experience, you can be uniquely useful to other alcoholics. That doesn't say because of your own feelings and emotions. That doesn't say because of your addiction or your addictive tendencies. It's my drinking experience. That's what makes me useful to others. So cooperate, never criticize. To be helpful is our only aim. And I have next to that highlight, because of your own drinking experience, you can be uniquely useful to other alcoholics. I have a side note that says T5, because that's tradition five right there in its purest form. When you discover a prospect, and that's what they're using in here, a prospective member of Alcoholics Anonymous, not yet a pigeon or a sponsee or a baby or whatever you want to call them, but a prospect, a prospective member, find out all you can about him. If he does not want to stop drinking, don't waste your time trying to persuade him. That should be a highlight. I don't know why that's not highlighted in my book. That should be a highlight. You may spoil a later opportunity. This advice is given to his family also. They should be patient, realizing that they are dealing with a sick person. If there's any indication that he wants to stop, have a good talk with the person most interested in him, usually his wife. Get an idea of his behavior, his problems, his background, the seriousness of his condition, and his religious leanings. You need this information to put yourself in his place, to see how you would like him to approach you if the tables were turned. So what that's telling me is I got to find out if, like, let's say that he is a hardcore atheist. That's going to tell me to not come at him from a certain angle, right? Let's say that he has been saved by Jesus Christ, and that's, you know, he's got crosses around his neck, and what that's going to help me, that he's not going to be skittish with the spiritual angle. There's going to be things that I'm going to need to know so that I can better, you know, that's why they call it a pitch, right? And I know that that's controversial. Some people don't like the pitch because it's almost like we're trying to sell something. Well, to the newcomer, we are pitching something, you know, we're pitching this way of life. So sometimes it's a waste of time. Sorry. Sometimes it's wise to wait until he goes on a binge, right? Like there's nothing better than that gift of desperation. The family may object to this, but unless he is in a dangerous physical condition, it's better to risk it. Don't deal with him when he's very drunk, unless he's ugly and the family needs your help. So if you have to call the cops or something like that, wait for the end of the spree or at least for a lucid interval. Then let his family or a friend ask him, and this is another highlight for me, ask him if he wants to quit for good, not for one day at a time. Don't waste your time with that. And if he would go to any extreme to do so, because if he just wants to quit until the end of the month, until he can get his court card signed, if he just wants to quit until he can get his job back, if he just wants to quit one day at a time until, you know, his wife lets him back in the house, I don't want to waste my time with somebody like that, because there's too many other people out there who want to quit for good, who are done, who have that gift of desperation. So I, you know, it says here, this is a clear cut direction. Ask him if he wants to quit for good. And if he would go to any extreme to do so, you know, this whole chapter just as a reminder, because I know I said this when we were reading the doctor's opinion, but if you overlay the doctor's opinion and working with others, put one over, it's exactly the same chapter. It's exactly the same information. It's exactly almost word for word. Like this direction that Silkworth, or this direction that Wilson is proposing, is directly from Silkworth. Like that's where he got all of his 12-step directions and then some experience of his own on top of it. But, you know, where it says here, if he would go to any extreme to do so, where isn't that familiar? Where did we hear that? Well, we heard that on page 58. It says, in step zero, I call it step zero, right in the middle of the page, our stories disclose in a general way what we used to be like, not what it was like, what happened and what we are like now, not what it was like now. And if you have decided you want what we have and are willing to go to any lengths to get it, then you're ready to take certain steps. But if you haven't decided that you're ready to quit for good, for good and for all, which is what this book says. Or if you're not too sure about what any lengths means and you're like, well, I mean, I'm not going to go to a meeting every day or anything. Or, well, I mean, I don't have to do all the steps, right? I don't have, well, then you're not ready yet. It says it right here. If you've decided you want what we have and are willing to go to any lengths to get it, then you're ready to take certain steps. Then you're ready for the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. So going back to page 90, ask him if he wants to quit for good and if he would go to any extreme to do so. If he says yes, here's another direction, guys. Those who are still recovering, close your ears. You don't want to get offended here. If he says yes, then his attention should be drawn to you as a person who has recovered. That's hope, right? It's telling me to approach the prospect as a person who has recovered. Offer them hope. This is not a one day at a time staying sober from one meeting to a next, white knuckling it for the rest of my miserable life until I eventually drink or shoot myself. That is not something that is going to catch the attention of somebody who wants to get better, right? So you should be described to him as one of a fellowship who, as part of their own recovery, try to help others and who will be glad to talk to him if he cares to see you. How simple is that? I love the simplicity of that. If he does not want to see you, never force yourself on him. Neither should the family hysterically plead with him to do anything, nor should they tell him much about you. Never should the family hysterically plead with him to do anything. What does that sound like? Intervention? Yep, sounds like an intervention to me. What do I call intervention? What does the book call intervention? Frothy emotional appeal. And guess what? It seldom suffices. The message that can hold, we have to have depth and weight. That magic of Me Too is the only thing that can crack those tough egos, right? So interventions, I don't know, they might get you in the door. And hopefully then once you get in the door, we can grab you. We can get you to stick. But interventions never did anything for me. If interventions worked, then we wouldn't need AA, right? So they should wait for the second. They should wait for the end of his next drinking bout. You might place this book where you can see it in the interval. I always love that part. Like there's such push a book of Alcoholics Anonymous like by your bedstand, subtle hint. Here no specific rule can be given. I love that. No specific rule can be given because of tradition 9, right? We're not organized. We can never organize. AA as such can never be organized. For those of you who are at the workshop at noon, really amazing meeting. Wow, that was a good meeting at noon. Not because I was, I don't mean, I that sounded really, I was the speaker, but other than that, like the script and like the format and all that, amazing noon meeting. I think I found my new Friday noon meeting. It was really good. So I love this because it says there's no specific rule that can be given because we don't organize 12-step work, right? We don't show up with a script. We don't show up with a script and we have to use this language of the heart and we have to use discernment. And that's why this chapter is so big and so thick. That's why this one of the biggest chapters in the book is because there's no rule of thumb. There's no clear-cut directions on do this and then say this and then your prospect will do this and then you say this. Like, nope, it doesn't work that way with step 12. Some of the other steps, yeah, clear-cut directions. Step 12, that's where the language of the heart comes in. That's where God has to come in. That's where I'm just a conduit, you know? I have to pray before I go into step 12 and I have to be willing to be led, you know, to leave my brain in my car and bring my heart in and in a clear channel. So the family must decide these things, but urge them not to be over anxious, for that might spoil matters. Usually the family should not try to tell your story. When possible, avoid meeting a man through his family. Approach through a doctor or an institution is better yet. I make up words sometimes. And Adam, unintentionally, an institution is a better bet. If your man needs hospitalization, he should have it, but not forcibly unless he's violent. Let the doctor, if he will, tell him he has something in the way of a solution. When your man is better, the doctor might suggest a visit from you. Though you have talked with the family, leave them out of the first discussion. Under these conditions, your prospect will see he's in under no pressure. He will feel that he can deal with you without being nagged by his family. Call on him while he is still jittery, right? Because that's when he's going to have that gift of desperation. And I know that for me, that gift of desperation sometimes had a really short expiration, life, right? I am desperate. I'm never going to drink again. I'll do anything. And then after a couple of days, I'm feeling a little better. Maybe I made too big of a deal about it. Right. So that's why I call on him when he's still jittery. He may be more receptive when depressed. I'll say, see your man alone if possible. At first, engage in general conversation. After a while, turn the talk to some phase of drinking. Tell him enough about your drinking habits, symptoms, and experiences. Notice how it doesn't say tell him enough about your feelings, thoughts, and opinions, about your emotions. I've noticed that. It does not say to tell him about your feelings, thoughts, opinions, and emotions. It says, and this is why it's only one alcoholic with another, right? That's why there's so many different 12-step fellowships, is because identification happens in the matter of fact. The rest of the steps is where we can talk about the feelings and thoughts and the emotions. But for step one, what does it say? Tell them enough about your drinking habits, symptoms. The bottle was but a symptom, but it's our common symptom. It's the symptom that we need in order to get that magic of Me Too. A crack pipe is not a common symptom for me. For this alcoholic, a needle is, I mean, you guys, I'm not talking politics here because this has nothing to do with whether I'm pro-mask or not mask or any of that, but I haven't been immunized. And it is not because I don't believe in immunization. It's because I'm scared to death of needles. I cannot relate with a heroin addict. So tell them enough about your drinking habits, symptoms, and experiences to encourage him to speak for himself. You know, that magic of, oh my God, I can't believe I drove my kids home in the back of my car and I don't remember how I got home. All I remember is covering one eye so that I can see the road. I didn't know anybody else did that. I did that. How did you know my trick? Because we're a drunk. Drunks do that, you know? Like, I woke up and I have no idea where, how I got home or where I went or what I did or who I did it with or God knows how, you know? And it's like, yeah, that's the story of my life because I'm a drunk. Those are the things, those are the magic of me too that you want to talk about with that prospect. If he wishes to talk, let him do so. Right? Maybe he starts saying, oh, I've done that too. And then you can say, really? Tell me about it. Right? And then they get to talk. You will thus get a better of idea of how you ought to proceed. If he's not communicative, give him a sketch of your drinking career up until the time you quit. So talk more about yourself, right? If there's no clear-cut directions, it's saying if he's doing this, then do this. If he doesn't do this, maybe try this. But say nothing for the moment of how that was accomplished. So I have that highlighted because I got on this for a couple of years. I got on this role where I would be at, every time I was asked to tell my story, not talk on a step or a tradition, but tell my story. One of the first things that I would say up to the podium is, I'm not going to go and tell you guys my drunkalogue. Everybody here knows how to drink. Let's get into recovery. And I would skip what I was like. I would skip identifying for the newcomer. And I'd get straight into recovery. Nobody is going to want what I have if they don't know that what I have is the same as what they have. You know, and I did that. I'm not alone. Bill Wilson did that for the first 6 months of Bill Wilson's sobriety. He was the worst 12-stepper in the history of Alcoholics Anonymous because he went around telling everybody about the solution and he totally forgot to even mention the problem. He just wanted to tell them about his bright light experience and how the windows blew open and this God came in and removed his obsession and he hasn't wanted to drink. And Dr. Silkworth is like, well, of course what you're doing hasn't helped anybody. Like, they think you're weird. Tell them about your drinking, about that physical allergy that once you start drinking, you have an inability to stop. That allergy. Tell them about your mental obsession that no matter how many times you swear it off forever, for some reason, you always pick up again. Tell them about that first. He said, Bill, you have the cart before the horse, is what Silkworth said to Bill. This was days before his visit to Dr. Bob to try out the new method, his first prospect that he had success with. And when he tried this out on his first prospect, Dr. Bob, Alcoholics Anonymous was born. That was Mother's Day, 1935. But it wasn't until he tried this new method of, no, let's not talk about the solution until we talk about the symptoms. The problem has to be the same for the solution to work. But say nothing for the moment of how that was accomplished. If he's in a serious mood, dwell on the troubles liquor has caused you. Being careful not to moralize or lecture. If his mood is light, tell him humorous stories about your escapades. I have a few. I love talking about my humorous escapades. I used to think that we don't do that in AA. You know, I used to say, I'm not going to tell you about my drunkalogue. Oh, a third of my story should be my drunkalogue. What I was like is a third of what my story should be, right? Not just what happened and what I'm like today. That's called bragging. You know, we got to identify first before we start bragging about what the program has given us. Get him to tell you some of his, you know, maybe he can tell you some things that have happened that are funny or tragic or whatever he wants to talk about. When he sees that you know all about the drinking game, not about the feelings, not about the emotions, not about the opinions, or, you know, when he sees you know all about the drinking game, commence to describe yourself as an alcoholic. Tell him how baffled you were, how you finally learned that you were sick. Give him an account of the struggles you made to stop. all of those things. Show him the mental twist, which leads to the first drink of a spree. I am for any piece of literature that's conference approved literature, anything. Because I believe God expresses himself through the group conscience of the United States and Canada, expressed through our group conscience. Having said that, one of our books, one of our pamphlets, it's a booklet, and I won't use the name. A lot of people, a lot of big book people don't like this book. And, you know, I was one of them. It gives a lot of human power. And I've since made amends to the meeting that was studying it. I'll tell you what the book was, because I'm not going to talk bad about it. So the book Living Sober is a book that AA publishes. It wasn't going to be published, and Bill did not want to publish it. But after Bob and Bill were both passed on, Lois had it published. But the reason for this book is it has some really good tips in staying sober before we recover, right? Like eat candy, don't go to the bar. Like these things that help the alcoholic who has not yet recovered to stay sober. Well, I got a chip on my shoulder because in my town, sometimes I'll see like living sober studies sometimes as people who have years of sobriety using these tips. And it's like, that's not what it's for, right? And so I did make the, I don't know, this was like 7-8 years ago. I made some comment. I came to a Living Sober book study and I made some comment at group level along the lines of, I mean, and I'm not proud of it, you know, but I made some comment along the lines of that the only thing the book is good for is when you run out of toilet paper. And I ended up having to go back, you know, it took me 6 months to get the willingness to go back. And I did make amends to the group and they forgave me and they were very tolerant with me. But you know, I still don't use the book. I mean, I used the book when I was brand new because I had I didn't have a higher power, right? So I needed that human power to keep me sober between meetings while I was doing the steps. And it even has a warning in the front of the book. It even says, and I didn't read this, I just wanted to see the bad stuff. It says in the front of the book, this is not a program of recovery. This is not AA's program of recovery. You know, this is for the newcomer. This is simple tricks and so that you can, until you get sober through the program of recovery, which is outlined in these books and these pamphlets. And it even gives a list and it says to go get the big book. But I didn't care about any of that. I just talked a lot of crap about the book. Well, a few years back, I remember this guy who I really look up to in AA. I love his sponsorship. I love his sponsorship line. I love his sobriety. I love his, you know, brand of all 36 spiritual principles. And I found out that he uses living sober with his guys. And I'm like, felt like I was, you know, kicked in the stomach. And I'm like, how, why, what? Explain this to me, you know? And he says, well, I give one to every one of my guys that have been around the program for a while, that have been around the rooms for a while, have not yet been able to get sober. And I tell them to highlight everything in that book that they've already tried that has not worked. And I'm like, oh, that is a really good idea. And that's what this is saying here is, now I've lost my place. Dang it. I get to talking. Oh yeah. Okay. So tell them how baffled you were, how you finally learned that you were sick. Give them an account of the struggles that you made to stop. Show them the okay. Give them an account of the struggles you made to stop. And then I like to ask what struggles he's made to stop. Right. And this is where you can open the book Living Sober and they give you tons of, you know, have you tried to swear it off forever? Have you tried to stay home from the party? Have you tried to, you know, have an escape plan and go in and leave before the party starts? Have you tried switching front to sugar? Have you tried doing all this stuff? And they start saying, yeah, plus I've tried to not drink on weekends. And you're like, oh yeah, that's in the big book. Like, let's read that, you know, and they start explaining, they start even giving you experiences right out of page 30 off the, or 31 out of the big book, you know, more about alcoholism. And you can start listening for their similarities and open the big book and start reading their story to them. And it's like the look of how did they know is amazing, right? That magic of me too is amazing. And I'm not against that pamphlet or that booklet, Living Sober. I think that it could be helpful to give it to a newcomer and say, you know, highlight everything in here that you've already tried that have failed. And maybe that's why we need a spiritual program of action. So he will match your mental inconsistencies with some of his own. And I love that. If you are satisfied that he is a real alcoholic, not if he's satisfied he's an alcoholic, but I thought we don't diagnose ever anyone. Oh no, we don't diagnose newcomers who are coming into the fellowship. And there's no requirement to be a member of the fellowship. The only requirement is a desire to stop drinking. But if you're asking me for your help, if you're asking me to walk you through these steps, I don't just have a spiritual right. I have a spiritual obligation to make sure that you're a real alcoholic, or else I could do some real damage, not only to you, not only to me, but to the entire fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. So if I'm satisfied that he's a real alcoholic, and let me give you an example of what that might look like. I'll use two examples. And they're both true. And these are both real life experiences that I've had. One, we sit down and we read, you know, the doctor's opinion, page 44, page 21, those, the qualifying pages. And they identify with all of that, right? And they're like, well, no, let's go the opposite way first. Let's say somebody is saying, well, no, I mean, I am an alcoholic. Let's say they're calling themselves alcoholic, right? Well, I'm alcoholic. I just, you know, I like my alcohol in powder form. Okay, well, let's forget about the drugs for a second. What happens when you first take that first drink of alcohol? You mean snort that first line? No, I mean, take that first drink. Well, I don't really like the taste of alcohol. Okay. So, but what happens to your insides, even though you don't like the taste? I'll say, I don't like the taste either. So what happens when you take that first shot or that first drink? Well, I don't know. I don't really like the feeling it gives me. But that's okay, because I have the ism. Okay. Well, so what happened the last time you drank? Oh, somebody had handed me a glass of champagne on New Year's Eve. And I was already so high, I thought I might as well drink it. Maybe I like it this time. I got halfway through the glass and I couldn't finish it. It was disgusting. All right. So let's go check out some meetings in CA. Let's go check out some meetings in NA, right? Now, on the other hand, because I'm not satisfied you're a real alcoholic after that description. Now, on the other hand, let's say somebody doesn't want to call themselves alcoholic. So that one's calling himself an alcoholic and she's not. Let's say somebody doesn't want to call themselves an alcoholic. No, I just have a little drinking problem. I'm not an alcoholic. Okay. So what happens when you start drinking? Well, I'm not addicted to it. I rarely drink because I have such a low tolerance for alcohol. That's why I could never be an alcoholic, because once I start drinking, like, I end up blacking out and puking, and I could never become addicted to alcohol. I am like the opposite of an alcoholic. I just, for some reason, you know, can't handle it. Okay. So once you start drinking, you get so drunk, you puke. All right. Yeah. Doesn't sound like an alcoholic to me. I don't have to use that sarcasm with them, but I can take this information internally. Right. And then I can say, well, then why don't you just, I mean, if you don't like, if you can't handle your liquor, why don't you just stop? Well, I don't know. I don't know, you know, and in our big book, it says sometimes they're honest and they tell you that they really don't know why they start drinking. And in their hearts of hearts, they don't. And so I can say, well, have you ever tried to quit forever? Well, yeah, yeah. But then I think maybe I can just have one on, you know, my birthday or whatever. And then it always ends up bad. But I'm not an alcoholic. I just have a drinking problem. Okay. I don't care if you're satisfied you're an alcoholic or not. You don't even have to know you're an alcoholic at this point. The steps will bring that into very clear perception for you. But at this point, I don't care what you think. I am satisfied that you are an alcoholic. If nothing else, at least a potential alcoholic. Like, I don't have to tell you that. I don't get to diagnose you that. I don't get to call you an alcoholic. But I am satisfied that you are an alcoholic of my type and that we can start working these steps. Right. And that is my spiritual obligation to get that information before moving forward in this book. If you are satisfied that he's a real alcoholic. So now we've already talked about the physical and the mental. Right. Now we get to get into the spiritual. So if I'm satisfied, begin to dwell on the hopeless feature of the malady. Show him from your own experience how the queer mental condition surrounding that first drink prevents normal functioning of the willpower. Don't at this stage refer to this book unless he has seen it and wishes to discuss it. And be careful not to brand him as an alcoholic, right? Even though I know you're an alcoholic, I don't need to tell you because this, you know, the steps will take care of that. Let him draw to his own conclusion, right? Because I don't want you thinking you're an alcoholic because Carrie told you you are. I want you to admit to your innermost self that you're a real alcoholic. That is step one. Let him draw to his own conclusion. If he sticks to the idea that he can still control his drinking, tell him possibly he can. Here's a $20 bill. Go step up to the nearest bar room. Try some controlled drinking, my friend. Let me know how it turns out. if he's not too alcoholic. And I love the sarcasm with that, but insist that if he is severely afflicted, there may be little chance for him to recover by himself. Continue to speak of alcoholism as an illness, a fatal malady. Notice how this book never calls it a disease. It never uses the D word. There's a lot of D words that I don't use in AA. Talk about the conditions of body and mind. I have those two words highlighted because that's where we find identification, the body and the mind, which accompany it. Keep his attention focused mainly on your personal experience. Explain that many are doomed who never realize their predicament. Doctors are rightly loath to tell alcoholic patients the whole story unless it will serve some good purpose. But you may talk to him about the hopelessness of alcoholism because you offer a solution. So they're saying doctors sometimes don't want to tell the prospect, their patient, you're alcoholic because doctors don't have a solution. Doctors don't want to give that bad news without, you know, a pill or a program or a, you know, something to fix it, right? And you can't just go pick up a prescription at the pharmacy to get rid of alcoholism. So doctors don't like telling patients that they're alcoholic because there's no hope aside from spiritual. But we can do that because we offer a solution. You will soon have your friend admitting he has many, if not all, the traits of an alcoholic. If his own doctor is willing to tell him that he's an alcoholic, so much the better. Even though your protege might not have entirely admitted his condition, right? Because I'm not going to just come out and say, oh yeah, you're a drunk. Sorry. You know, I'm going to wait till they come to that conclusion. He has become very curious to know how you got well. Let him ask you that question, if he will. Tell him exactly what happened to you. Stress the spiritual feature freely. If the man be agnostic or atheist, make it emphatic that he does not have to agree with your conception of God. He can choose any conception he likes, provided it makes sense to him. The main thing is that he be willing to believe in a power greater than himself and that he live by spiritual principles. When dealing with such a person, you had better use everyday language to describe the spiritual principles. And I take that as I use everyday language to describe even, you know, I don't ask, do you get the phenomenon of craving? No, I say, have you ever been to out to happy hour where you said, you know, maybe you were just going to stick to two and then you changed your mind? Yeah, I have. Oh, you did change your mind. Yeah. But I don't get a craving. I just changed my mind. Oh, okay. So you were going to have two and you changed your mind and only had one. Well, no, you had more than two. Okay. That's the phenomenon of craving, right? I just don't call it the phenomenon of craving with them because we're sticking to everyday language, right? Something that they can understand. When dealing with such a person, you had better use everyday language to describe spiritual principles. There is no use arousing any prejudice he may have against certain theological terms and conceptions about which he may already be confused. Don't raise such issues, no matter what your own convictions are. I love that. I love that. My sponsor has a higher power that she could very easily name. And I had no idea what her higher power was until one day, 3 years after we were working together. And we work very close together. Once a week, we sat in Jackson's corner and, you know, it was 3 years, 3 years before I noticed something around her neck. And I'm like, what is that? We were out to, you know, doing step work at the restaurant. And she looks down, she goes, oh, oops, I usually put that under my shirt when I'm with sponsees or in a meeting. And I'm like, I had no idea. And she's like, well, it has nothing to do with your higher power. And I'm like, I am so fortunate to have that as my influence, you know, as my teacher, like amazing. Her job is to help me find my higher power and to better my relationship with my higher power, not introduce me to hers. When dealing with such a person, okay, your prospect may belong to a religious denomination. His religious education and training may be far superior to yours, which is mostly the case for me. If that's the case, he is going to wonder how you can add anything to what he already knows, but he will be curious to learn why his own convictions have not worked and why yours seem to be working so well. He may be an example of the truth that faith alone is insufficient, right? Faith without works is dead, as this whole book repeats over and over again. Now I have this highlighted. To be vital, faith must be accompanied by self-sacrifice and unselfish, constructive action. That's a big sentence. It's not a long sentence. It's a heavy sentence. It's a big sentence. To be vital, faith must be accompanied by self-sacrifice and unselfish constructive action. Ugh. Whew. Let him see that you are not there to instruct him in religion. Admit that he probably knows more than you do. But call to his attention the fact that however deep his faith and knowledge, he could not have applied it or... or he would not drink. Perhaps your story will help him see where he has failed to practice the very precepts he knows so well. We represent no particular faith or denomination. We are dealing only with the general principles common to most denominations. I'm going to stop there because it's 4 and because this is a good right third of a way through this pair. This is going to be a big Step 12 is a big step. Lots of information. And again, it's because, you know, you can't just, I can't just come with a script to do 12 step work. It has to come from the heart. I have to learn how to be a channel. I have to learn how to be, to accept the intuitiveness that comes, when I'm open to hearing where the conversation needs to go. And this chapter has so much meat. It's so much good information that I really don't want to miss any. So that's why I saved these last 3 weeks for the 12th step. It's a lot of good stuff. So with that, it's four. Back to you, Dee.
Oh, I just love it. That was awesome. And that was beautiful, Carrie. Thank you. And thank you all of you that are here, whether you've just joined us or whether you have been with us a while, whether you're a fan of Just the Big Book or I say Just the Big Book or Carrie, the way she puts it in demonstration and her love for Alcoholics Anonymous, I really appreciate it. So thank you. And I'm stalling for questions. So send them questions, guys. Well, I mean, I really mean what I said, by the way. So, let's see, what do we have? Do we have any, do you have any, Carrie, that might've been sent to you? I have somebody saying thank you and all of that, but.
I can take another couple of paragraphs and see if we get any after that.
Absolutely.
Want me to do that? Okay. So the outline the program, I'm back on page 94 again. Outline the program of action, explaining how you made a self-appraisal, how you straightened out your own past and why you are now endeavoring to be helpful to him. So obviously, I mean, for those of you who are new or nearly new, a self-appraisal is when we take inventory in four and five. Straightening out the past is when we clean it up in eight and nine. And then obviously doing our 12 step work is why we're being helpful to him. It is important for him to realize that your attempt to pass this on to him plays a vital part in your own recovery. Actually, he may be helping you more than you are helping him. Make it plain that he is under no obligation to you, that you hope only he will try to help other alcoholics when he escapes his own difficulties. I love that because, and I have that part highlighted, that you hope only that he will try to help other alcoholics when he escapes his own difficulties, because sometimes I will start working with a very excited newcomer. Some of my newcomers are not very excited, and I actually like those ones a lot, the ones that are really desperate and angry and hateful and tell me that they hate me and all that, because they're willing to do the work, right? But then there's some that are super, like they get on a pink cloud and they're excited to do the work, and they, what can I do? What can I ever do to give back to you? What do, you know, and they try to buy me gifts and whatnot. And I just got another one in the mail that I have to have a conversation with this sponsee. But I, you know, and this is what I take them to. I said, this is what I want from you is once we get done with this process, you got to give everything that I gave to you away to someone else. That's the deal. That's the spiritual handshake right there. Like, you got to give it away. That's all I want from you. You know, when I buy somebody a big book, they say, well, I'll pay you back as soon as, no, I don't want you to pay me back. I want you to buy somebody else a big book who can't afford it. You know, this is the ultimate pass it on program, right? And so that's what it's about. And when I do take someone through the steps, I'm taking them through the steps as if they were to teach them, to help them to learn how to take someone else through the steps. So I was working with this one woman earlier this week, and she has, you know, she's got 6-7 years of sobriety, and she's new to me, not new to AA. And she, you know, we get onto we agnostics, and she's, oh, well, I don't need that chapter. Cause I'm like, you don't need it, but I'm not doing this for you. I'm doing this for those that you're going to help. That's why we're going through this work, not for you, for those that you're going to help, you know, because that's what the whole goal is here. Suggest how important it is that he may place the welfare of other people ahead of his own. That is so important, right? This isn't a selfish program. It's a selfless program. It's a less of self program. Make it clear that he is not under pressure, that you needn't, that he needn't see you again if he doesn't want to. You should not be offended if he wants to call it off, for he has helped you more than you've helped him. If your talk has been sane, quiet, and full of human understanding, you have perhaps made a friend. Maybe you have disturbed him about the question of alcoholism, right? Belly full of booze and a head full of Alcoholics Anonymous. Maybe you've ruined his drinking for him. This is all to the good, it says. The more hopeless he feels, the better. That gift of desperation is really a gift. He will be more likely to follow your suggestions. My husband's sponsor, when I was new, he wasn't Jeremy's sponsor yet, but David, I used to hate David because he'd say things in the meetings like, I'm a fan of pain. And I'd be like, what a mean, mean man, you know? And now I get it. Like, he's a fan of pain because without that sufficient bottom, nobody's going to do the work to recover, you know? And now I catch myself saying things like, I'm a fan of pain. Oh, anyway, that's another paragraph. Have we gotten any questions yet?
Yes, ma'am. Thank you. Good job. If it's just if it's not their pain, it's your pain for them. It's just a bad day, right? It's got to be their bottom. I have somebody asking about that in regards to sponsees. So what is the relationship like between a sponsor and sponsee, like if the sponsee relapses? So with you, how does that look like when somebody's gone out and come back in?
Okay, so first of all, every relationship between every sponsor is going to be different. And I'm not even talking about every relationship, every sponsor is going to have a different type of brand. I'm talking about, even for me, every relationship with every one of my sponsees is a different relationship. I used to be a very cookie cutter, but I realized that, you know, what works for some might not work for others, right? Like, for example, the brand new newcomer who comes in and she's so shy that she comes in 5 minutes late and sits in the back row and she's not getting into anything. She's not going to join a home group, not a joiner. Why don't you come sit up next to me in the front row? And tomorrow I want you to be 10 minutes early. Oh, and by the way, the leader's looking for somebody to read how it works. Would you like to do that? Right? Say I have the newcomer who just got out of treatment and knows everything about recovery, right? They just got out of spin dry and they're going to tell everybody, this is what you want to do. And you better know your triggers and you better, you're going to need to keep your mouth shut for a while. Why don't you sit in the back of the room and you need to listen? And when you're asked if you would like to read something, you say, I'm sorry, but I don't know anything yet because I haven't started the steps. So everybody's going to be a little bit different and everybody's going to need something a little bit different. And again, that's why this step can't be organized and why this chapter offers us so much discernment. But as far as my relationship goes with my sponsees, I've sponsored hundreds of women and so far, the women who have gotten all the way through step 12, and I'm not talking about raising your hand in a meeting. I'm talking about the women who have actually taken someone else through the 12 steps. That's what I count as the 12th step. The women who have actually taken someone else through the book. I haven't yet had one drink yet. They're all sober. That's not a testament to me. That's a testament to Alcoholics Anonymous. So far, I haven't had one drink yet. The ones that start the steps and think that I am not the easier, softer way, which they're right. And they decide they want the easier, softer way. And they go, you know, seeking out a different sponsor, then that's wonderful. And I support them wholeheartedly. I've even given out lists of sponsors who are, you know, maybe more what they're looking for with contact information. And I don't try to do the whole, I told you so, nothing like that, because then I'm not going to be a safe person for them to come back to, right? it's going to be harder to come groveling at my door, which is what usually happens after they try a couple of the easier, softer way. Sometimes it takes a year, sometimes it takes 3 years. And then when they come back, after they've drank and they're like, I can't believe I drank. I'm like, why can't you believe you drank? You're an alcoholic. That's what we do, right? I mean, I can't hold that against anybody. That's why we need the steps. If you can stay sober without doing this stuff, then you don't need AA. So my arms are open to you. And I did have one. So there's this one girl that I was sponsoring who I was a sponsor in name only. I don't do that now. Like I went through this one phase where I was like, I don't fire anybody. If they don't want to do the work, that's up to them. I'm not pushing them. Well, it's true. I still don't push them, but I let them know that they're not being sponsored and they should probably find someone they can better take directions from, you know? Because it's a disservice that I'm doing to them if they think they're being sponsored in AA. And then when they go drink, they're like, I was sponsored in everything. No, you weren't. Not by me, because you weren't doing what I suggested. So there was this one girl and she came in drunk and ready to take a 2 month coin, right? She's all excited to take her 2 month coin. And she hadn't done anything. I mean, this girl, nothing. She hadn't even cracked the book. And she comes in and I know she's been drinking. I mean, she made it obvious. She didn't know that she was being obvious, but there's no way I was going to let her get up in front of everybody and take a coin, because for her sake, not for anybody else's, I don't care about everybody else, but that'd be really embarrassing for her. Right. And so we're sitting there and she's like, are you going to give me my coin? And I said, I think we should go outside and talk. And she's like, okay, as soon as the meeting's over. I said, no, right now. And so we went outside and I said, listen, I love you. You can't take a dirty coin. I can't let you take a dirty coin. You've been drinking. And she just started crying and she's like, okay, so I guess this means you can't sponsor me anymore. That's the only reason I have to lie to you, is because you're so hard ass that you can't blah, 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 you know, and she's crying. And I said, no, actually, Tara, this means that I can sponsor you. This means that you're an alcoholic. If you were still sober after 2 months of doing jack, then I might be curious as to if you're a real alcoholic or not. Like, this is good news. You know, if this means you're ready and willing to start the work, this is good news. But if you were still sober, ready to take a 2 month coin, and you haven't even opened that book or done anything with me, then that I might have to question whether I could sponsor you or not. But this is good news. Like, are you done? I mean, go drink it up before you, I mean, get real good and done before we start the work.
So what is the number one reason, knowing that I know you take a survey, what's the number one reason that most people seem to go back out when you ask them why, or when you ask them the certain way that you do? Because you mentioned that about the steps, and we're in this step right now.
Yeah, well, I mean, when people come back to meetings, what they say in the meeting at group level, which is such a disservice, what they usually say after 20 years sober, I'm just throwing 10 years, 30 years, whatever. Let's say for the sake of this one woman who I have in mind, 20 years sober. And she comes back and she said, you know, picks up a white chip and she says, it is bad out there. You know, and she thinks she's doing a good service. And she's like, you know, we're never safe from a drink. I can't believe that I left AA. I know that I had been falling short on my meetings, blah, blah, blah. They always say it's because they started skipping meetings. And it's like, okay. So after the meeting, I go up to them and I have my sponsees do the same thing for our own. You go, she said, I did the research. So, okay. So let's ask you about the research so that I don't have to do it myself. Right. And I say, when you went out, how many sponsees did you let down? If you don't mind my asking, like, well, I didn't really sponsor. I did other service work. Oh, you didn't sponsor. Okay. Huh. Because I belong to a 12-step program, not an 11-step program. So were you still taking personal inventory? Were you still meditating and praying? Well, no, I never really got that far. Oh, okay. Good to know. You know, it's like, no, it's not the meetings. It's not doing the work. And I know that because this one guy, he actually prided himself for years on, you know, I don't do sponsorship because sponsor's not in the big book and blah, blah, blah. Right. And he was definitely a meeting maker. He made meetings multiple times a day, not just every day. He was in every meeting in Bend. Like, you couldn't go to a meeting without seeing this guy. Now, when he showed up drunk, it's like, well, what's your excuse? Well, the guy never sponsored anybody. The guy never took anybody through the big book, you know? And then, so here's the opposite story, which I also don't recommend. And I'm not trying to set an example for everyone because this is obviously selfish and self-centered. But my friend, who it's been 3 years now since he passed, passed away with 40 years sober, 40 years sober. He passed away on his sobriety birthday month, the same month that he turned 40. And he hadn't been to a meeting in over 15 years. But he did more working with others than anybody I ever knew. Actually, we took the hard cases to him, right? Like, we took him the hard cases because he was a hard nose. Like, he didn't come to meetings because he said they weren't real AA anymore. He said he didn't want to come to meetings because it makes him less useful when he's so worried about, you know, he said he's never done drugs. He doesn't want to hear about drugs. He doesn't want to hear about your sober living house. He doesn't want to hear about, and it just made him depressed going to meetings. But he sure was helpful to those people that, you know, we would drop him off the bad drunks and he would take somebody through, and he was retired. He was old, and he could take somebody through the big book like you wouldn't believe. And they would have a spiritual awakening and then they would help others. But he hadn't been to a meeting in over 15 years. Died sober, died happy, died useful, died whole.
So speaking of that, do you, what do you suggest or how do you handle when you get a sponsee that has to attach that ANDA on there when you first meet them at a meeting, right? They won't let go of that ANDA. How do you deal with that as a sponsor to a sponsee?
Well, I mean, it's none of my business if I'm not their sponsor.
No, if you're sponsoring it, if you're sponsoring.
I don't sponsor people with the ANDA because I go over the sponsorship requirements and it's in there. That it's in there before it's part of like what my expectations are is that you're just an alcoholic, you're one among many, and you don't distinguish yourself as something different than anybody else. And that's part of what I have them consider, a small part of the, you know, of what I have them consider in that 24 hours of prayerful contemplation before agreeing that they would like me to sponsor them.
Gotcha. Thank you. And then we have someone that says, do you, where is it? I have a good few sponsees. An average time to do the steps thoroughly is between 30 to 90 days. Many people criticize my way. I usually have to tell them to be quiet in nice words. Nowhere in the book does it say take 1 year or take your time, but everyone seems to take a pop at me. How best to react with conflict? Because many times it does end up in debates. Then I seem to come off like a lecturer.
Spiritual experience, bottom of the first page of Appendix 2. What often takes place in a few months could seldom have been accomplished by a few years of self-discipline. That's how long the big book says it should take to go through the steps. So I don't know.
Repeat it one more time so that the people can slowly find it so they can mark it in their book.
So spiritual experience, Appendix 2 in the back of the book.
Mm-hmm.
Toward the end of the page, about four lines up, what often takes place in a few months could seldom have been accomplished by years of self-discipline. So I mean, everybody's different, and I hate to sound like a cliche, but if somebody has a problem with the way that you sponsor, then it's their problem and not yours. And, you know, so long as you're not out there getting on people who are trying to help people go through a step a month, you know, I mean, if people want to go through a step a month and you're getting on them for that, well, you know, we step on the toes of others and they retaliate seemingly without provocation. But, you know, if they have a problem with the way you do it, that's their problem, not yours. You're just following the directions outlined in the big book.
Beautiful. You know, I have a sponsee that has a sponsee that very same thing happened, because like nowadays we're doing a lot more of this remote sponsoring. And this girl is done and ready to have a sponsee, ready to experience step 12 herself. And yet some of the women in her home group, which her sponsor does not attend with her because it's an in-person, you know, home group, the women in that group are telling her that she's not ready. How would you handle that? You know what I mean? Like, I mean, we know it's not their business, but that's your home group, that you're surrounded by those kind of people. And so when people come in and you're ready to sponsor and you're raising your hand to be that, they're suggesting that you don't because you're under a year of sobriety.
Yeah, I'm really, so this is probably not a great answer, but I am at this point, especially after this past year and a half in the pandemic, I am so pro home group that I don't want to say anything that's controversial too much, but I am so pro home group that if they have a home group that cares about the way their members are going through the steps, right, wrong, or indifferent, if their home group all has the same, like, they have unity around something. Oh man, I wish I had a home group like that. You know, I mean, honestly, even if they're doing it wrong, home groups are so important, and the unity of a home group instead of having, and I don't know, I'm to the point where, you know, it's rare that I sponsor someone who can't make my home group. Or that I can't make theirs.
Right.
Because I do want, I mean, your home group is your connectivity into Alcoholics Anonymous. So I don't know. I like to meet people in my home group to sponsor. And when I'm at other people's groups, and I'm talking about personal meetings, in-person meetings now, when I'm at a meeting across town and they ask people who sponsor to raise their hand, I don't raise my hand. I'm not going to take your sponsees, your newcomers at your home group. That would be arrogant and rude of me. That's not even a meeting that I can usually attend because it's an evening meeting, right? I go to daytime meetings. So I let you sponsor your newcomers in your own home group. And I try to take sponsees that come to my home group. And that way there's no turf wars.
Well, that brings in another beautiful question. So stick around for a few minutes, you know, if you can after, and I just want to ask a little bit more on that, but I want to get to a couple of these others real quick. Do you introduce the 12 traditions to a newcomer fairly quickly, not like study them, but impress upon the newcomers how vital they are to our survival? But I'm going to wrap another question with that because I think it'll answer this other one. What are your sponsorship requirements? So I know that goes in with that too. So we can kind of touch that.
Yeah, my sponsorship requirements are pretty, I'm just getting a copy and paste. They are pretty accustomed to what my experience has proven effective and not effective. And I hate to just give you that middle section, which is the sponsorship requirements, because there's a whole bunch that comes before and after that, including what I do as a sponsor, what I don't do as a sponsor, and then what I expect of you. And the only reason, you know, it's that sounds super controlling, right? Well, try to enter into a bunch of relationships where this person isn't know what to expect of this person, and this person doesn't know what to expect of this person. And then 3 months down the line, you're both going, what the hell is going on? It's like, let's even the playing field, lay everything out on the table. Here's my cards for your, here's the tools. I'm going to lay out the tools for your inspection. You go home, study it, consider it, and then enter into the relationship if you think you can meet these requirements. And so some of them are very basic, like an honest sobriety date, you know, an honest sobriety date in my sponsorship line, which everybody's different. And this has nothing to do with the traditions of Alcoholics Anonymous, because the only requirement for membership to be a member of AA is a desire to stop drinking. So you can do as much heroin as you want. You can, you know, whatever, like, and good for you. You're stopped drinking. That's awesome. But if I'm going to sponsor you, that means an honest sobriety date is when the last time you have self-medicated by deciding for yourself to put anything into your body that affects you from the neck up that is not as, even if it's prescribed by a doctor, taken as prescribed by the doctor. You know, that's your honest sobriety date. I don't care when you quit drinking. When is the last time you gave yourself medication without a doctor's help? And so that's one of my requirements, is that honest sobriety date. This is how I introduce my sponsees. I just put it in the chat, to some of the traditions. It's really, really lightweight. Traditions 101. We don't call them traditions. We call them meeting etiquette. They don't know that they're getting kind of a introduction into the traditions. It's stuff that's just common sense. You know, maybe before you get up to use the bathroom, wait until the person sharing is finished sharing, or reading, or whatever, so that they don't think that you have offended them or that they've offended you. Really basic, you know, even though you have other problems, let's just identify as an alcoholic when we're in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. We don't read outside literature in the meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. We just keep it simple and stick with AA literature, like just some simple stuff. We don't call it traditions, but it's an intro into the traditions. And so that's what I give them, that suggested meeting etiquette. And you're welcome to take it if you like.
Awesome. I'm going to give you a quick last one and then we can close out. And if there's anything else, how would you approach an individual that clearly has a problem, yet they know you are in the program and are a relative?
Could you read that again?
Yep. How would you approach an individual that clearly has a problem, yet they know you are in the program and are a relative?
I wouldn't approach them. I mean, maybe I'm misunderstanding the question. I might be misunderstanding the question. I have
the person will stick around. They can ask it.
I'm leaving to go on vacation in less than a week, and I go to this dude ranch, and my whole family is alcoholic. And my in my dad's side of the family, we have not produced a non-alcoholic yet. It might happen someday. my cousin Billy. Oh man, he gave me a heads up that he's going to be at the ranch and he needs me to be his protector so that he doesn't drink. And I gave him a heads up that the only thing I can offer is to buy him a bottle so that he leaves me alone and doesn't expect anything from him. He cannot get sober. The guy gets 30, 60, 90. He lives in California. And I think he's been through like probably every sponsor in California. I know a lot of people in California and they find out, they're like, oh, Billy is your cousin. Oh my God. I'm like, yep. He's arrogant. He knows everything. He doesn't need, you know, to follow the directions in the book. And so he's going to come to the ranch with us. Surprise! Oh, goody. And he's going to be drunk the whole time. And I'm not going to offer to take him to a meeting. I might go to a meeting, but that's his business, not mine.